This week's parsha is Parsha Vayechi, which is the last parsha of the book of Bereishit, the book of Genesis. And the title of this class is Parsha Vayechi, Was Yaakov Part of the Call-Out and Cancel Culture? You'll find out. Okay, but just to get everybody on the same page, what is the call-out and cancel culture? So we're going to go to a video. Obviously, you saw that coming. And let us go to the videotape. Here we go.
Not long after he got the gig, critics almost immediately started blasting the popular actor and comedian for old tweets and comedy routines they say were homophobic. Hart initially refused to apologize, and then just hours later, he called it quits.
Hey,
overnight, Kevin Hart bowing out of a gig
Kevin,
he called the opportunity of a lifetime. Writing on Twitter, I have made the choice to step down from hosting this year's Oscars. This is because I do not want to be a distraction on a night that should be celebrated by so many amazing, talented artists. I sincerely apologize to the LGBTQ community for my insensitive words from my past. He added, I'm sorry that I hurt people. I am evolving and want to continue to do so. My goal is to bring people together, not to tear us apart. That apology coming shortly after he posted a more defiant video on Instagram.
So I just got a call from the Academy, and that call basically said, Kevin, apologize for your tweets of old, or we're going to have to move on and find another host. Talking about the tweets from 2009, 2010. I chose to pass. I passed on the apology.
The comedian's change of heart coming just 3 days after he was tapped to host the 2019 Oscars. Following the announcement, critics pounced, condemning several of his old tweets and comedy routines as homophobic.
That boy's cooking, man.
In one of those since-deleted posts from 2011, Hart reportedly wrote, Yo, if my son comes home and tries to play with my daughter's dollhouse, I'm going to break it over his head and say in my voice, stop, that's gay.
One of my biggest fears is my son growing up and being gay. That's a fear. Keep in mind, I'm not homophobic. I have nothing against gay people. Be happy. Do what you want to do. But me being a heterosexual male, if I can prevent my son from being gay, I will.
Earlier on Thursday, Hart tried to explain himself in another video on Instagram.
Guys, I'm almost 40 years old. If you don't believe that people change, grow, evolve as they get older, I don't know what to tell you.
At 39 years old, the stand-up comic has become a bankable Hollywood star, appearing in a string of big-time blockbusters. But hosting the Oscars brings a new level of scrutiny. Usually, hosts are criticized for what they say during the Academy Awards, but Hart won't get that chance after exiting stage right.
So, Miguel, I mean, this is Hollywood. Any talk about who could possibly replace him?
Well, Savannah, when they selected Hart, you would think that the Academy had several candidates to choose from. It's possible that one of those candidates could then step up to replace him. We did reach out to the Academy and to Hart. There was no comment overnight, Savannah.
All right, Miguel, thank you.
All right. That was a year ago. Okay, just FYI, they didn't find, they ended up having no host for the 2019 Academy Awards. And no host for the 2020 Academy Awards. So apparently they went off the, I don't know, for whatever reason, they found it too problematic. Or were, you know, they're nervous that that would be a problem. Okay, so let's go to the, okay, let's get to some questions here. All right, let's get some of the, let's go to the screen. Okay, question number one. What was Kevin Hart's crime? All right, anyone want to get it? What was Kevin Hart's crime that he got summarily canceled, called out, then canceled from the Oscars?
He's like, you know, the face of like movie franchises and he said these like horrible things when he's supposed to be like a role model for like, you know, younger people.
Right. So,
as, like, you know, but like,
he did say them 10 years earlier. And the question is also, he's a comedian. So is there any, I mean, there's a difference if, you know, there's a difference between if a rabbi during a Shabbos drasha says something, you know what I mean? I think that has one level, but what Scott is saying is correct. In other words, the crime was in the social media and, you know, public, in the court of public opinion, was that Kevin Hart is homophobic or violated the crime of thou shalt not express homophobic feelings in public. And then of course gets to the question, did the punishment fit the crime? What do you guys say? I got a head shake from Suzanne. Well, raise your hand if you think that's a fair thing that Kevin Hart, the comedian, should get publicly booted off, basically brutally pre-fired before he gets to do the job. Is that a fair punishment for making homophobic comments both in his act and on Twitter 10, 12 years earlier? What do you guys say? So Suzanne is shaking her no.
I do think that they should have approached him first and then talked to him and gave him a chance. But as far as the fact that I see nowadays even more so that it's not about being a role model. It's more that community, specifically the arts community, is out there for the rights and the safety of all the minority, quote unquote, the BIPOC and the LGBT community. So that itself is like a stab to them.
Now obviously you can infer what was the Academy, you know, what was their initial solution?
Apologize.
Make a quick apologize and you'll keep on going, you know what I mean? You'll apologize, I'm sorry, and you'll still get the gig. But what happened? I think two things happened.
Well, he made it public that he was asked to make the apology, so...
He made a public video on Instagram saying they asked me to apologize, and I'm not apologizing. Okay, which of course made everybody more, those people who felt that he had violated an enormously terrible thing, double down on him. And then, you know, I made the joke, I'm learning with Rabbi Sacks, I said, I guarantee you that Kevin Hart, agent is a Jew. I Google, who is Kevin Hart's agent? Michael Berkowitz. He could have been in my class. I mean, Michael Berkowitz, if you Google him, he looks as Jewish as the Western Wall. I mean, he's like the guy's, Yid City over there. So
Kevin's emotions took over.
Right, so...
He probably didn't think before posting that YouTube video, and then his agent was like, you gotta, like...
Yeah, you know, I know the call said, Kevin, you've already lost the gig of a lifetime, which is to host the Academy Awards. Let's make sure you are employable in Hollywood. You are going to tweet and also make that heartfelt video in bed that we're evolving and we're changing and we're doing tshuva and it's Yom Kippur and on a chatasi avisi pashati, you know. I could hear, like, over his shoulder was Michael Berkowitz and his team of PR damage control specialists saying, what are you doing? Our business, our parnasa, is depending on you walking that the way back. So everybody saw that wasn't exactly the most heartfelt apology. But anyways, I think we got Larry. We got Larry in the house. Good to see you. The bottom line is, The truth is that I'm not supporting publicly or even privately making jokes about gay people, homophobic jokes. Okay, but again, there's a couple of things here. Not every, you can't. One of the challenges of the call out culture, which we'll get into, is judging people by the morality or the values of today of what people did like 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I mean, 20 years ago, every politician was against gay marriage. Just everybody remember, like, 20 years ago, the big compromise that Bill Clinton had worked out was in the army was, anybody remember?
It was a big don't ask, don't tell.
Look, so that was the compromise. All right, the bottom line is, we're not asking, you're not telling, you could serve your country, and we're not interested in your private life. Okay, that was good. But that was not, but the gay pride and the LGBT community effectively pivoted and made it a civil right to be homosexual. And they were extremely effective in changing the feelings of America.
Actually, the world too, because even Israel has moved in that direction quite substantially as well.
Yeah, correct. Israel as a country is very, gay, is fairly gay.
Gay pride is huge.
Yeah, gay pride. They have the gay pride.
Gay pride is huge.
Gay pride parades in Tel Aviv. Gay pride in Jerusalem. Yeah, it's big. So the bottom line is, but leaving that, so that's the whole conversation in its own right. But the question is, was it right that Kevin Hart should be essentially fired for this job? I don't really think so, because, even if you say that a homophobic comments are bad, why should a guy lose his job? I mean,
but if it were Jewish, and we've had this happen where somebody says something anti-Semitic, like a Mel Gibson, and it also depends whether it's 10 years ago when you're 30 years old or whether it's 10 years ago when you're 15 years old.
Okay.
So I think that also has some kind of, and also if it's 30 years ago, you're 60, and you did it when you were 30, and times have substantially changed, and you have been known to have changed with those times against, be it as saying something against Jews or women or gays or minorities or anything like that. It also depends on how you handle it.
Okay, so Marvin is bringing an excellent point. Let's say Kevin Hart had made anti-Semitic comments either in his act or on Twitter 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Now, first of all, the crew that's in charge of vetting hosts for the Academy Award would have caught that one. being that the entire everybody who are the non-actors but administration of Hollywood is largely a lot of, there happens to be a Jew or two in Hollywood, last I checked, so that probably would not have gone too far. But I think your point is well taken. So that gets into our really the question I want to just focus upon, which is what are the limitations of the call out and cancel culture? And what are three ways calling out is distinguished from the mitzvah of rebuking? The mitzvah of hocheach, tochiach, chesamisecha, you shall surely rebuke your fellow. Okay? What is the difference? What are the limitations or what are the features of the call out culture? I might only pick one, but if you Google call out culture, it's all over the place. People are, without me going on, what are the limitations of the call out and cancel culture? What are the problems with it?
Well, it's severe. People can't think and people can't talk anymore. And, even talking about legitimate issues, some subjects are just totally off limits. And we see that on college campuses. You can't talk about being pro-Israel on a lot of college campuses. You cannot have a Benjamin Netanyahu come to, I think he wasn't prime minister at the time, he came to one of the universities in Canada, Brandeis University, would not accept the Israeli ambassador to the U.S. as a commencement speaker because they were concerned that some Palestinian students at Brandeis, a Jewish institution, would feel bad.
Correct. So that's an excellent example, Marvin. In other words, the call-out culture is so intense that even important foreign issues immediately are called out accounts and derided, you know, in public and social media, and makes the situation, makes the environment a toxic environment. That's an excellent point.
And the Jewish community is guilty, too, because I've seen many occasions where anti-Semitism has been used. Oh, you're against us. You don't support what we want to do. You're anti-Semitic.
Correct. That's also true. You can, in other words, one way to call out the your enemy is to say, well, if you don't support Israel or don't support the Jewish community in every way, you're automatically branded an anti-Semite. You know what I mean? For example, we just had that issue in the state of New York, where the question was the application of Cuomo's laws of shutting down shuls, which the Supreme Court rolled back. But people said, oh, Cuomo's an anti-Semite. Cuomo's not an anti-Semite. You may not agree. You may not think he's the best. You may have a lot of thoughts about him as our governor. We're those who are listening online, this is we're in New York State. But he's not an anti-Semite. And the fact that Jews were flaunting, social distancing laws, I think they have a lot to explain about, because there's a Jewish principle of pikuach nefesh. You have to be very careful to avoid the loss of life, and being not careful. So, in fact, all the Supreme Court says that the governor is allowed to make the law. It just has to be equal. You just can't say, well, shuls, 10 people. Everybody else, bars, could have a much more relaxed situation. So the question was the even administration of enforcement, but he has the right and should have the and should if there is a spike in infection that houses of worship, if they need to, have to close like they did in March and April and parts of, and May. Okay. One issue.
Rabbi Penny.
Yes.
Can I add one thing?
Please.
So going back to the Kevin Hart, I think it's a good point that he's a comedian, because I think it's a slippery slope if you start censoring comedians, because one of the things that makes comedy work is that the comedian is saying something that everybody thinks but doesn't feel comfortable or is afraid to express. But when they do the work for you, all you have to do is just listen to it. It resonates and you laugh. But if everyone's censored, then you have that's why I feel like sitcoms today aren't so good, because they're very
politically correct,
very superficial, not offensive. So that's why it's comedy works because it has to be edgy.
Correct.
You know, for entertainment, you don't have to watch Kevin Hart if you don't like him.
Correct.
Right.
You know, to Larry's point, I was watching old episodes of All in the Family, and I think, oh my gosh, if they tried to do that today, everyone would be offended. They can't say anything. It was really funny then, though. I mean, Archie Bunker offended everyone, and it was hilarious.
I do question, though, also, if what Kevin did was part of a skit or routine and it offended people, that might have been different than the thing at home or the personal stuff.
Okay, I hear that, but I think to Larry's point that comedians provide a social benefit. The benefit is
like
the
provocateurs, right?
Provocateurs providing satire, like sort of like what was like the jester in the court of old would say things in a funny way, which would people were certain truth that people were to articulate through humor, uncomfortable truth that need to be discussed.
Versus Mel Gibson,
correct.
He's not known as a comedian. He's sort of known as an anti-Semite who has these beliefs and goes around and has other issues of anger and domestic violence. So he's not in the comedic realm, and he's
correct.
It's a little different for him.
Correct. So excellent point as well. The one of the limitations, let's go through the limitations of the call it and culture and the cancel culture. First of all, is that all this is done in public. You know what I'm saying? In other words, in Judaism, we don't believe in public rebuke. If a person has an issue, if somebody did something wrong, if somebody inappropriate, the person that has the greatest influence in their lives, has a responsibility, has the mitzvah to go to them privately and discuss it and try to improve them. In the call-out cancel culture, there's no love. There's no love here. There's no interest in improving Kevin Hart. There's all about punishing Kevin Hart. Judaism about when somebody makes mistakes, the goal is to improve them. And the person who is mandated to do that is the friend who loves them and wants them to be the better version of themselves. In the call-out and cancel culture, the social media, the public becomes the jury, the judge, and the executioner. Who are we going to go out after next? Who are we going to go out? We don't like what they said, whether they said it now, whether they said it a long time ago. That's it. Next point is sort of an unrealistic standard. Just another example. Prime Minister of Canada, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, was in a skit or a play or a thing where he wore blackface. Okay, it wasn't last week. It was like a long time ago, and he was like in college. And if everybody had what they did in college in the public, you know, things I did in college on the front page, I don't think that anybody would be holding their head up too high. Most people, when they're young adolescents, do dumb things, make mistakes, and they don't have to pay for that. They don't have to pay for that eternally. So that's the point. The call of culture is not from your friend. It's from a gang that wants to take you down. Two, therefore there is no love. Three, there is no interest in tshuva. They don't want you to improve. They're more interested in war and vengeance. You are now the new enemy. We got to destroy you. Conversely, the mitzvah of tochacha is I, as a friend, see that my friend is doing something wrong. I have to be able to, in a thoughtful, kind, loving way, bring the person in quietly and have a conversation and to point out in a way that the person will hear something that the error that they made. That is a completely different thing. Now we have, it's funny, we're living in a very anti-religious time. You know what I'm saying? Where religion in America is the people who are devoted to religion is becoming less and less and less. People in their 20s and 30s are way less interested in organized religion than their parents and certainly their grandparents. But their religious attitudes have not really, they've just changed. They're now secularly religious. And if you talk to a person who's, whether they're a pro-Trump person or an anti-Trump person, as we discussed in other classes, that's a new religion. And it becomes a new orthodoxy. What's the orthodoxy? The orthodoxy of the Republican Party. The orthodoxy of the Progressive Party. You know what I'm saying? And if you step out of line, they will get you. They'll take you down, okay, if they can. You know what I'm saying? If you're trying to be progressive and you are, as Marvin mentioned before, which is a very interesting thing, many Jews, as you know, by day, I deal with the Orthodox work on college campus. We're on 23 campuses. So you have a very interesting phenomenon. You have secular Jews who politically are progressive, who would have voted for Bernie, okay? But they still feel positive toward the state of Israel. There's no space to them in the college campus if you are progressive and pro-Israel because of intersectionality. You can Google that later. They have to now align with all the victims. Who are the victims? Black people, women, gay, transgender, Palestinians. Palestinians are the victims. And who are the bad guys? The mighty Israelis. So you can't be progressive and pro-Israel. You got yourself a problem. because Israel is no longer a Baruch Hashem after many, many years of hard work, and God's blessing is no longer victimized in the same way they once were. Okay, let's go on to the... All right, so that's my introduction to get into our conversation tonight. All right, so let's have somebody read. All right, Marvin, read me the first... this is going to be sort of our global verse from Mishle, from Proverbs. Read it out.
I'm not seeing it. I see where
I'm sorry. Sharing. You know what? Because I'm not sharing it. So that would be okay. That would be amazing if you could see it.
That would be really good, yeah.
All right. I'm sorry about that. Take two.
Okay, from what is
King Solomon. King Solomon, yeah.
Okay, let me just move something else here out of my way. Okay, from King Solomon states in Proverbs, whose ear heeds rebuke, discipline of life, lodges among the wise.
Okay, so... if you guys are familiar with the book of Proverbs written by King Solomon, it's all a book of one-liners. Oftentimes that the one-liner could be divided into two parts. It says, Ozen shoma tochachat, the ear that hears, that listens to rebuke, correction, chayim bekerv chachamim talim. Ozen shema tochachat chayim. I apologize. I got to put the comma in the right place. The ear that listens to the rebuke of life. He lives among the wise. That a person who is all right. Which of course brings out the question. Question number four. Read it out.
Is he making a statement that is in support of the cancel culture of that time? Am I misinterpreting?
Well, we're going to get into that.
What is the casual connection between listening to tochachat and lodging among the wise?
Right, tocha means rebuke. Yeah. So what's the connection? He says, if anybody who listens to the rebuke of life, he lives among the wise. Why he can't live among the wise and listen to rebuke? What does that mean? What is King Solomon getting at?
Continue here, Jacob.
That's a question. Now I want to hear you guys. That's a question to you all. What do you guys think? Who can answer question number four?
So I think he's trying to say, like, if you listen to someone's criticism without, like, just kind of like putting your fingers in your ears and like tuning them out, like maybe you could learn something, or at least like when you want to criticize something that you know they're supporting, like they'll listen to you, kind of like a two-lane road.
Okay, yes. But so why does it say that person lives among the wise? How does King Solomon know that?
He's not shutting himself off from learning, or maybe changing his opinion if he has a bad one.
Exactly. In other words, this person who has the humility to listen to either a criticism about either his lifestyle or a critique of his idea, and he's open to that. He's open to hearing that and saying, hey, you know, maybe that's a good point. That person, by definition, is a person living among the wise. This person is a wise person. In other words, he has to be a person who, in other words, because what happens, and we see this in today, one of the challenges of the algorithms of social media, okay, is that if you click on whatever political view, whether you be on, let's say you're on YouTube, and let's say you click on a political view, whatever it is, X, okay? What will the algorithm learn about you and automatically do? Come on, guys. I know I'm not the only one who watches YouTube.
It will feed you what they think you want to watch. Things
right.
Are similar.
They will give you, because the goal of YouTube is to have you watch endless commercials. So you saw this political view? They know they have a very sharp algorithm. People who like this also like this. Oh, and you click on that. Oh, we know a little more about you. And you click on that, and you end up listening to only your own view. You don't hear anything else. The term of that is called, you're living in the echo chamber. King Solomon says, no, you cannot live, it's not healthy to live in the echo chamber because you're not going to learn anything and you're not going to grow. A person who's open to, in other words, they're listening to the wise, living among the wise people who will point out they'll ask a question about your position. Or if there's something going wrong, they're not going to be uncomfortable with saying, I think what you've done is not 100% proper. You know what I'm saying? And if you can live in such a space, you're going to grow. You're going to grow. But most people want to live in the echo chamber. They want to consume the viewpoint that they have, and they want to have more of it. Okay?
But isn't there a risk, though, because so many politicians simply put their finger up in the air and they go in the direction they think people want them to go?
Yes.
And a lot of Hollywood goes in a certain direction, like including anti-Israel, because they think that is what is acceptable, that is what is popular, that's what people want to hear.
Correct.
And I've seen this with politicians from both parties where they'll just, just using an example, Chuck Schumer, he was, I think, voting multiple times to move the embassy to Jerusalem. And when the embassy moved to Jerusalem, it may not be the right time. It's this, it's that.
Right.
Because he was now the head of the Democratic Senate.
Correct. Obviously, no. So that's the opposite. The goal of a good politician, we discussed this on the various partial classes, not to give the people what they want, is to give the people what they need. And, this attitude is so completely absent from our culture. It's like, I'm just trying, sort of like, it's like it's coming out of everybody does not want, nobody want, people want to criticize everybody who is not like them. That's what people criticize, and they'll call them out and they'll cancel them, or try to. There is no real, as was mentioned before, there's no real dialogue as an interest of learning new things, deepening my perspective, broadening my horizons, okay? Which used to be the mandate of the, liberal education in America. But that is long gone. Okay, let's get to the Parsha. Let me have somebody read. Let me have Shana read. Jacob's blessings.
Jacob called for his sons. When they came, he said, "Come together, and I will tell you what will happen in the course of time. Come and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my strength and the beginning of my manhood, first in rank and first in power. Because you were unstable as water, you will no longer be first. This is because you moved your father's beds, committing a profane act. He moved my bed. Shimon and Levi are a pair. Instruments of crime are their wares. Let my soul not enter their plot. Let my spirit not unite with their meeting. For they have killed men with anger, maimed bulls with will. Cursed be their rage, for it is fierce, and their fury, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob, scatter them in Israel. All these are the tribes of Israel, 12 in all, and this is what their father said to them when he blessed them. He gave each one his own special blessing."
Okay, so the context is, Yaakov is 147 years old, he's about to die, he calls all of the 12 sons to gather around around his bed, and he's going to bless them. And the first three sons, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, as Shannon just read, sort of excoriates them. Doesn't seem much of a blessing. So in fact, Rashi sort of clarifies exactly what this sort of poetic language means. This is approach. So let me have Marvin, you want to read? Superior in rank? You're on mute. Marvin, you're on mute.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
Superior in rank, Hebrew, Seet Yeter,
yes.
Worth it to be superior over your brothers with the priesthood, an expression of raising up the hands, Nisiyut
Kapayim. So yes, there's the eight extra. I mean, literally, superior in rank. But so se'eit also has a connotation of lifting up. So Rashi infers from that really that Reuven should have had what job? Him and his descendants should have got what job?
The Kohanim.
Yeah, the priesthood, becoming the Kohanim. Reuven's the firstborn. He should have got that. Let's go on.
To recite the priestly blessing and superior power, Yeter
Oz.
Oz.
Yeter Oz.
Yeah, strength. Superior with king, kingship, like, and he will grant strength to his king.
That's from Samuel 1, and that comment is from Genesis Rabbah. So basically, what does superior power mean? That's a foreshadowing that really that Reuven should have got what other job? What other job would he had in the Jewish
king.
People?
To be a king.
The king. The kingship should have emerged from him. Okay, in other words, basically, in what Rashi is inferring, that Yaakov is saying in a poetic way, Reuven, you and your descendants were headed to be the priesthood and the kingship. But not happening. Why not?
Pachas
Kamayim.
You have the restlessness of water, the restlessness and the haste with which you are hastened to display your anger, similar to water which hastens on its course. Therefore, you shall not have superiority. You shall no longer receive all these superior positions that were fit for you. Now what was the restlessness that you exhibited? For you ascended upon your father's couch, then you profaned that name that ascended my couch. Is the Shekhinah, which was accustomed to going up on my bed.
Okay, so let me explain that. So why did basically what did Yaakov say to Reuven? What did Yaakov say to Reuven?
Lost your spot.
You're fired. You're fired. You're fired. Okay. What happened? And what? Because there was an event that Yaakov is obliquely referring to earlier in the story. The Torah says that after Rachel died, that Reuven went up to Leah's concubine Bilhah. Plain reading was that he slept with her. He slept with the Yaakov's concubine wife Bilhah. The Midrash says, which is the whole question, moved the bed. Now, the question is, the Medrash says, Rashi's saying he moved the bed. Now, one way of understanding that is that, did Reuven actually sleep with his, there were two major wives, Rachel and Leah, Rachel and Leah, right? And each one had a slave, which then they each one gave to Yaakov to have more children. You're right, the maidservant. So from the plain reading that after Rachel died, out of nowhere, it seems that Reuven slept with Bilhah. So the Medrash says he didn't actually sleep with Bilhah, but he actually, that he could not tolerate that his mother, Leah's, honor is being negated. And he moved the bed of Yaakov, of which wife he should sleep with. So midrashically, his involvement in the sexuality of his father is so improper, so inappropriate. It's as if he slept with the maid maidservant. Okay, that's the whole question. Is that the plame shot, the medrash? I'm not going to get into that whole point, but the key point is that this showed as the pasuk says, a restlessness, a impetuousness. And therefore, since he's impetuous, what is he not fit for?
Leadership.
Excellent. Now, not only that, he then, as Shana said, what did Yaakov have against Shimon and Levi? What was their problem? We discussed it in previous classes. He critiqued them also.
Well, the way they went about revenging their sister's rape.
Yes. What? The killing of all the people in Shechem. All right? He said, cursed be your anger. So he basically, cursed be your rage, for it's fierce, their fury, it's cruel. I'll disperse them in Yaakov, I'll scatter them in Israel. The Levi doesn't have a set, they're given 42 different cities to live in. And Shimon are not clustered, they're sort of scattered about. Okay, so the question, of course, is relative to our class. Why is Yaakov calling out Reuven, Shimon, and Levi and canceling them?
Because he feels their actions don't represent the qualities of a good leader. The characteristics of a good leader.
Exactly. In other words, he's not being mean to cancel them. He sees that there's a problem, and he's addressing that issue forthrightly. He's not putting it on social media. He's not telling everybody in the world that this is a problem. He's having a private conversation in the family about a family problem, and families sometimes got to sit around the old kitchen table and hash out problems. That's a healthy thing if it's done properly. Now, here's my question, a bonus, I didn't put a question in. Why did Yaakov wait till his deathbed? We've asked this question in the past, but I think it's a good one to focus upon now. Why did Yaakov wait till he's literally in his death, he's not figuratively on his deathbed, he's in his actual deathbed. He actually, after this whole thing, he dies. Okay, so he's on his deathbed. This is his last day.
Is it because, maybe they'll have to respect his wishes?
Good. Why? Why do they have to respect his wishes? Why?
Because it's, it's his last, pronouncement or,
what is the idea of respecting? That's an ancient concept of respecting a person's last wishes. What is that all about? Is that justified? Just because it's the last wish, does that mean it's automatically a good thing?
No, but I guess it comes with a little weight to it, a little bit more.
It does. It has a lot of weight to it. People really, in all the good movies, and my dad said on his deathbed, you know what I mean? That's the stuff of good movies, right? So, but the idea is that, and specifically for the last wishes of a wise man like Yaakov, because when a person is about at the end of his life, he has the totality of his wisdom. And there's no more agenda, and there's no more plans, and there's no more things to do, and there's no more interest. Basically, the way that you see things at that point is the way, that's the most objective and clear you can be. In a certain sense, Yaakov is calling the situation out, and this, of course, being aided with a prophetic insight. Yaakov is telling his family the way he sees it in the most clear and objective, honest, and truthful way. And before that, people can't and they know that he's not doing it for any other reason just to tell the truth because it's the truth. If it's earlier, they might say, well, he has this motivation and that motivation. There's no more motivations. It's game over. They know he's passing away in an hour. It's game over. So the drama of the moment, the truthfulness of the moment, is when you have to deliver, in a certain sense, in this case, very painful and bad news, they'll be open to listen. The Medrash says that Yaakov did not rebuke Reuven earlier or Shimon Levi earlier because he was afraid that he would get upset and he would go join his brother, his uncle Esav. You know what I'm saying? He would just reject his father and go with his uncle. You know what I'm saying? So when you tell the rebuke, and if it's very intense, you got to be concerned about is the person really up to listening to it? You know what I'm saying? So this was a teachable moment. This was the moment of truth. This was the last hour. He had their attention. They listened. Which gets us to question number 6. Why would a shomea tochachat, a listener of rebuke, do in response to legitimate rebuke? After hearing this, what should Reuven, Shimon, and Levi do the next week? What should they be doing? What should they be doing? If you get rebuke from your good friend, what should you do?
And this is already after Jacob had passed.
This is right. I'm just saying, but
at that moment.
Yeah, starting from that moment and continuing after he passed away. What if you were advising Reuven, Shimon, and Levi, the three oldest sons of the family? What should he do?
Well, if he's alive still, I'd say, apologize and say that you're going to learn from it and do better going forward. If I were that PR guy for Kevin Hart,
Well, this is not for PR. This is for you. In other words, your father just told you something very painful, and I understand this must hurt like crazy. And for that to be the last conversation you have with your father, you can only imagine the pain that it was. You have to think about it from that perspective. But on the other hand, you can learn from this. You can gain from this. And you can grow from this. And you should not waste that opportunity. And in fact, we have the interesting comment of the Ralbach. Let me have Elise. Got to call on you once. You're not coming to class. I'm not calling you. You are going to be called to That is going to happen. All right, good.
Okay. Many wonder about these blessings, as a number of Yaakov's sons did not receive a positive blessing, such as Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. The best explanation is that these blessings of the prophet are what will occur in the future, for without the forecasting, the blessing would have no benefit. It is critical that you know that informing others about the future, whether it be good or bad, is a blessing. Therefore, Hashem informs those who he related providentially what would occur to them in the future in order that they take counsel either to avoid evil or maximize the good that will happen.
So what the Ralbag is arguing, which people say like, what kind of bracha is that? Saying that cursed be your anger. That doesn't sound like a blessing. What the other ones are, if you read the rest of the blessings and Judah, they're going to have the crown, or there's stuff which is a classic blessing. You're going to get extra good stuff. That's a blessing. A blessing is getting extra good. How is this getting extra good? So the Ralbag argues, no, this is, albeit painful, this is a blessing. Because if you know what's going to happen, i.e. that you are not, because of your impulsiveness, you're not fit for leadership, what should you do? As Marvin said, you should improve. You should become better. If you have, if you're an impulsive person, if you get angry, like Shimon and Levi, and you become violent, you need to address that. That is a flaw that is going to hurt you and hold you back from future success, and by extension, your children, because our children mirror our behavior. What they see in the home, they will do. That's it. Okay, so therefore you do your best to be the best version of yourself, not only for yourself, that's a good reason, but as well as to be able to model a good behavior and excellence to your children. So what the Ralbag is arguing, this still counts as a blessing because it's now in Reuven, Shimon, and Levi's hands to improve. And now I'll just tell you a little. Now the question is, did they improve? So Reuven doesn't see many evidence of that, of improvement. Shimon was involved largely in the revolt against Moshe by the sin of Baal Peor. But Levi was able to channel their anger and aggression to join Moshe after the sin of the golden calf and mete out punishment against those people who had worshipped the golden calf. So they were able to use their courage and their aggressiveness in a positive way. So Levi listened. Reuven and Shimon, apparently not so much. Okay? Now, we got, of course, as I like to do now, end up with a scenario. Here we go. Scenario number one. Your much younger sibling, Pat, I purposely use the gender-neutral Pat, it could be male or female, admires you a lot and has tremendous trust in you. You both love and have loyalty to each other. Both you and Pat have each other's back. As much as you love Pat, you realize that they are still very immature, especially expressed in Pat's dating practices. Pat regularly ghosts on people they are dating. Pat will abruptly end dates with lame excuses. Pat is now having difficulty finding dates and complains to you about it. What should you do as the older sibling? All right, who wants to take that? Scott. Yeah, again. What are you telling to your younger sibling, Pat? Could be male or female. Go ahead.
You just, tell him about all his previous, dating and experiences, and be would the devil's advocate be like the right description?
Well, devil's advocate means that you're going to take the other position and just to argue the other side.
Oh. Okay.
So what are you going to do with Pat? You're the older brother. What are you going to do?
As the older brother, you're kind of responsible for the younger siblings. So you're help them out and talk it out and try and find, the underlying cause, I guess.
Okay, so you feel that as the older brother, you have a responsibility to sit Pat down in a loving way, but you got to break the bad news to that person. You got to break and say, "Look, you're basically sabotaging your dating situation by acting, in a nice way like a jerk." Okay, and you got to be able. And
somebody treated you like that,
right? And you have to deliver very painful bad news. Here's my question, Scott: would you do it?
If I were the older brother, yeah, sure.
Okay. Why? Whatever. Now, here's my question: do older siblings tend to do this with younger siblings?
Not every family is different, but
I understand that. What would be a reason that a person does not want to do this or would not do it? What would be the reasons that the older sibling would not have the sit down with Pat?
That Pat would be offended and Pat would be upset with the older sibling for interfering with his life. And I'm saying he, because the pattern there does seem to be a little bit more of a he pattern.
Okay, fine. So, and therefore what? And because of that?
They would have a worse relationship amongst themselves.
Exactly. In other words, the older sibling will not want to risk the relationship. Which is the following thing, that a person, I would rather have a good relationship with my younger sibling without trying to do an intervention and trying to improve his life. Because if it doesn't go well, I am worried that he or she will not like me at all or as much, or our relationship will become strained. And I don't want to do it. So I'm in a certain sense, by not doing tochacha, by not doing careful rebuke, I'm really being selfish. Because I'd rather have the good times relationship than help my sibling who is hurting themselves by their destructive self-sabotaging behavior. So tochacha, the reason the Torah had to make it a mitzvah, to make it an obligation, is because people don't want to do it. People do not want to do it. Okay? But if you have the influence, if you will be heard, you got to do it. You got to do it. And especially here, because if Pat is unconsciously unaware that they are alienating people for whatever reason, it could be this is what you want to do. Is that, look, I think there may be an issue with your dating. I want to suggest that you go see a counselor about it. You know what I mean? If you can pull that off. You know, sometimes people are open to going counseling. Sometimes they're not. But that's the mitzvah. And Yaakov, I guarantee you, Yaakov didn't want to do it. That's not his last, he didn't want that his last goodbye to Reuven, Shimon, and Levi was to say, cursed be your anger. That's not the nice goodbye. That's not a warm love and a hug and a kiss, right? But he knew that if they're to be successful in their life, they have to deal with their anger issues. Because if they don't, they're going to be struggling with that failure forever. Reuven is oldest. He's got a impulse control problem, acting flying off the handle. That's all, you know. So he has to tell them now, and hopefully that they would listen. His batting average was not too good, but he had to do it. So that really is the, while in the call out culture, a person sits in their house, on their chair, with their phone, being anonymous in the internet, and then just basically criticize all people who are not like themselves and gang up and try to punish people who don't think like they do. So they are not interested in real growth. They're just interested in punishment. We believe in appropriate, thoughtful, compassionate, loving rebuke. And that is a sign of a friend who loves another friend, and certainly a sibling who loves another sibling. Is that if there's a problem, you gotta, be able to suck it up to be able to address issues, and even if it means that you are putting a measure of your relationship on the line, you gotta do it. Now you gotta do it with wisdom, but you gotta do it. Questions, comments?
I was just going to mention, this is like totally resonating because Larry's going through this with his brother right now, where he, he doesn't want to affect his relationship with him, but, there are things regarding his dating or certain behaviors of his that he really wants to address with him, and he thinks his brother should talk to someone, but he fears that it's going to affect their close relationship. And it was interesting how you said that you feel that that's kind of like a selfish behavior. And I don't think, Larry would ever think that, like view it as selfish. I think that he's afraid that he doesn't want to upset his brother. He doesn't want to, and this is his older brother.
Right.
So this isn't really a younger, this is his older brother, but, this whole conversation was like resonating because I feel like that's exactly what Larry is going through. And we've had multiple conversations about it, whether he should say something or not.
Right. Now, obviously, it's not so, in other words, like saying something is not so simple. Look, if you know that a person is closed off to discussing a certain point, then to say something which is going to have no positive impact, a person shouldn't do that. But if you feel that you have a good shot, my relationship with this person is such that they know it's coming from a place of love and a place of kindness, and I can pull it off in an indirect kind of way and, you know, not clobber them over the head with it and just, you know, in a nice, gentle way, point out there's maybe something that you may want to consider, you know, do a soft touch to it, because just to, as a way to help the person out, because sometimes all of us, we are all blind to our own defects. We are geniuses at pointing out the defects of others, but blind to our own. That's just the way it is, okay? And to be able to, and that's why going back to what Marvin read from Michelet is that you will be living with the wise if you listen to the rebuke of life. There's not too many, and I will tell you something, there's not too many people living there. People cannot handle, you know, people can't handle the truth. People can handle rebuke. They just, that's why it's an art form if you're ever a manager of people, supervisor, and you have to criticize or, you know, critique work. It's a very challenging job. People don't really appreciate the, because the goal is you don't want to blow them out of the water. You want to keep the morale up. So there's an art, and by the way, if you want a supplemental reading for this class, I recommend Dale Carnegie, who really articulates some of the law, the rules of how to effectively, in the classic How to Win Friends and Influence Other People, is also how to deliver criticism and rebuke when you have to do it. And a long time ago in MJE, I pointed out that I made one sheet Dale Carnegie and the other sheet is the Rambam's Laws of Rebuke, and we showed the tremendous amount of parallelism. And I think that class is still on YU Torah. So that's it's a skill that people don't want to learn, and or people do criticize people when they're angry, in front of other people, you know what I mean, to make a big scene, because they just want to get revenge. But it has to be done, you have to pull it from that I want to improve the person. It has to come from a place of love. But it's something, and I can't, you know, every family struggles with this. Their family, they can't talk about certain things. I think that's nearly every family. Pretty much every family. So it's a mitzvah, which is important, but very hard to do. But if you can pull it off, that's, you know, that's a Jedi level of, you know, then you're really rocking. All right, guys. Wish you everybody a good night. Alayla Tov. And for those in the Senior Fellowship, look forward to learning with you tomorrow night.
Thank
Take care.
You. Thank you. Take care.
All the best.
Bye.